He is then proclaimed not any longer as a wise man or a student or a great teacher or something of that kind. The initiate of the mysteries had a strange and unique place which has never been filled since the decay or decline of that system. He was a being like God. The king of the country could not be seated in his presence without his permission. Every door was open to him. No man would dare to deny him anything that he asked, but for the strangeness of thought, of circumstance, he never asked for anything. He was strangely and completely aloof. And yet, he was in this world, but not of it. He labored, he served, he taught, he worked. And when the fullness of his years were done, he went to sleep in the earth like his brothers who had not been initiated. But he lived forever in a state of immortality, because within himself he knew that he could not die. He had returned to the gate of death and had come back again. He had passed through this complete internal release of the psychic nature of his own soul. And as such, he was a Mahatma, a great soul in the Indian language. And this great or illumined soul, as Julianus tells us, then sings the great and glorious hymn to the Mother of Mysteries, because she is the custodian, the faithful guardian, the forever keeping of all that is true and beautiful and noble and good. She is the soul itself, the beloved of all nations, the desired of all peoples. Now, the temple being, as it was, a peculiar emblem of the soul, the rise of the mysteries were represented in two degrees or stages. Whereas the body of man carries within itself the sanctum sanctorum, or the secret part of the heart, so within the heart of man the temple of the mysteries is built. And within man's own psychic life certain things must happen before the temple, which is everlasting, can be built. Here we have much symbolism which can find easy parallel in the story of the tabernacle in the wilderness and the building of Solomon's temple. All these rites and ceremonies have the same meaning. But the house that is built without the sound of hammers or the voice of workmen, eternal in the heavens, is of course the everlasting house of the soul, the mysterious temple, the mysterious body of the great psychic mother, Sophia Asimov, the great mother of the Gnosis. So Sophia, or the Virgin of Wisdom, is the house that can never be profaned, the mystery whose veil cannot be lifted, but who waits forever for the return of her sons, like the patient Penelope, weaves forever the mysterious fabric of destiny. All these things have something to tell us about the religious system of that time and what the secret of it was. We read frequently in various books of men trying to understand in this late time what was the power that maintained the mystery system for 4,000 years in the ancient world. What was it that caused the rich, the powerful, the great, the strong, the wise, the learned, and the simple all to hold this system in the most extraordinary admiration? What was it that was so strangely and wonderfully powerful that during its flourishing and its flowering, it produced the greatest minds and hearts and souls the world has ever known? It was in some way this mysterious power of actually releasing through its rituals a symbolic, mystical experience. The early church undoubtedly sensed this, because it created in its own form and in its own way the mystical Christian equivalent to the pagan rite, and that was the mystery of the Mass. The Mass was originally a mystical ceremony intended to convey certain parts of the old ritual, For the Mass as we know it, particularly the ceremony of the Eucharist, goes far back in Egypt and into the Dionysiac rites of Greece. But in some mysterious way, the Mass did not attain or achieve the purpose which was exemplified in the pagan ritual. That the Mass produced a very deep and profound sense of sublimity cannot be questioned. That a high Mass at St. Peter's today is one of the most tremendous religious experiences that man can pass through cannot be doubted. We know these things to be true. And yet in some way, this ceremonial, this tremendous pageantry did not and does not accomplish what the ancient rituals did accomplish. What then was the essential difference? Julianus says very simply one thing, and this is the basis of his great argument against the Christians. Julianus says that the difference lay in the disciplinatory rites. In other words, Julian says in his arguments that the criers of the pagan mysteries, or those who called the neophytes to their labors, said, let only the pure of heart enter here. Let only the dedicated come. Let only those who in themselves had achieved and attained be permitted to mingle in this sacred throne. The idea or principle being that in these ancient rites, religion or the religious experience was not bestowed, it was earned. This perhaps does have a large bearing on it. Perhaps Julian, who knew both and had experienced both, was in a better position to say than we are today because we cannot experience both. But Julian's opinion was definitely that before the individual can have this experience occur within himself, he must have attained to a certain level of merit. Plato and Pythagoras required certain prerequisites to admission into their sacred schools. Perhaps these prerequisites were to a degree symbolical, for we know that Pythagoras initiated his own slaves, and it is not likely that these slaves possessed the literal prerequisites which he required. But somewhere in this was a symbolism which had to do with merit or the earning of the right of acceptance into the state religion. So Julian says that the great difference lay in that the pagan required and demanded that those who sought truth make in themselves a proving of their own merit or their own sincerity, and that they might not enter the sanctuary except with clean hands and an upright heart. He says that the God of the mysteries was not saving the sinners, but was rewarding the just. Now this makes a peculiar difference in the psychology involved. And he was turned from his Christian baptism essentially by this particular circumstance, that he believed firmly that the individual who sought the consolation of God must bring something with him and not merely accept. Not pray for what he wants and continue to live the way he pleases. Not to hope for good things but do nothing in himself. Not to continue his common course of profane action and at the same time feel justified in claiming his participation in a religious mystery. That the merit system was at the end at the source of all these things. Now it is quite possible that it is not possible or not realistic that the sacraments which are performed in the presence of persons who are themselves not consecrated can have the same type of result as those in which the person is duly and properly prepared for this experience. Another thing that is, of course, great of importance in this is that religion in under this system, the philosophic culture of religion, was a decision of the individual himself. Men were not born into faith. They did not join their faith because their friends did, or because their relatives were members, or because it was particularly suitable to the location in which they lived. These kind of considerations played no part in the old mystery rites. The individual prepared himself for from 5 to 20 years of study, of self-control and discipline. Before he could approach the temple, he must bring from the community in which he lived proper credentials, proving that during this entire time he had been an outstanding citizen on the level of ethics, that he had performed no action that was contrary to the public good, that he was honest, intelligent, generous, kind, well integrated and well ordered, that he possessed courage and self-discipline, that he had proceeded in the gymnasium to obtain certain scholastic levels, that he was in every way dedicated and had given his whole life to the search for truth. Only then was he considered eligible for participation in the great orgies of the Blessed God. An orgy at that time had no such meaning as we ascribe to it today. It represented the great, strange, mysterious, and intoxicating pageantry of the soul, in which consciousness was picked up into an incredible exaltation and elevation of experience. So these things led Julian to feel and to believe that the mysteries of the Great Mother and of the Blessed Goddess were reserved for those who were true, and were reserved for the individual who was willing to sacrifice all else in the service of the Great Goddess. And until that decision was complete within consciousness, her rites could not be experienced because the soul itself was not ready. On a modern psychological level, I think we can begin to appreciate some of the possibilities of this and can think of it in terms of a potential problem in psychotherapy. Today, we are confronted with the great need of man organizing, purifying, redeeming his own psychic content. We know that the average person is burdened with a variety of pressures, intensities, frustrations of any and all kinds, that he is incapable of the relaxation and integration of a well-ordered life. Book learning will not save him. Allegiance to organizations will not save him. The only thing that can save him is the reduction of his own psychic pressure. Now, in psychotherapy today, we attempt to exhaust these pressures by certain therapeutic techniques, releasing the individual from the delusion or illusion which is causing his condition. It is conceivable, however, that society can produce and should produce individuals who, by their own actions, have prevented a neurotic condition from taking hold of themselves, and or having had such a neurosis, have had victory over it by the conquest of the things that cause it. Today, on psychological levels, we are working mostly with effects, and by the time we get an individual cleared from one complex, he is ready to fall into another. Such is the pressure of our time. And such it will continue until his proclivity to become complicated, his natural instinct to be psychotic, is overcome or changed by some greater instinct taking hold of his own consciousness. The soul, burdened by the pressures of our own psychic delusions, is transformed into a chimera, a monster of strange and distorted appearance and form. And this monster, in turn, prevents the individual having the experience of his own psychic identity, the troubled soul cannot find its own heart, its own integration. For that reason, in modern times, we could contemplate very seriously the possibility of bringing the soul itself back to normalcy, back to integration, by the dedication of the faculties of our minds and the emotions of our hearts to the restoration of the integrity of our own soul. This was the discipline of the mysteries. This is the one great part of knowledge that we have forgotten. And it is the failure to remember this that has brought the whole house of knowledge down about our ears. It is because the individual has forgotten that he can bring only himself to the house of the mysteries. And if that self is inadequate or improperly integrated, he finds not reality but illusion in the strange, dark, subterranean passageways of the secret house. It is therefore the great problem in wisdom for man to realize that his own confusion creates error, that he can be no more true than he is integrated, that he can be no more wise than he is at peace within himself. Until these elements and factors are recognized, the great rites or the ceremonies are not for him. Perhaps in earlier days, when life was less pressureful, the psychotic needs of man were not as strenuous as they are today, nor the demands upon his psychic energies so great. But certainly today, we are in desperate need of the restoration of the great mystery system of education, the education that begins with the integration of self, the education that advances only as rapidly as the individual proves by his own integrated abilities that it is safe for him to proceed in the great adventure of learning. For if he proceeds unqualified, he will ultimately be faced with the riddle of the Sphinx and will perish along the road of his search. Julianus then tells us these things, and we can then say to ourselves, what manner of man was Julianus, by means of which, reaching the end of his life at 32, he had still achieved sufficient of this mysterious ability to have merited initiation in himself. We may say, Julianus wasn't perfect. How did he do it? Why did they accept him, a young man, with probably but inadequate resources, and certainly no maturity in his real philosophic life? There's an interesting thing that comes into this also. Julianus, like all accepted candidates in the mysteries, was finally chosen by oracle. In other words, the candidate's final acceptance depended upon some testimony coming from the gods themselves. In other words, he must be accepted. Many are called, but few are chosen. Men may be called out of the world by the instincts of their own natures, but they are chosen by the divine powers. So what was it that caused, or might have caused, the acceptance of Julianus? One of the old legends, and one of the stories about him, tells us that when he came into the presence of Maximus the Neoplatonist, while he was waiting for the initiation into the Mithraic ceremonies at Ephesus, this Neoplatonist embraced him with great love and said, "My son, you have come back. That which you have already done has come to life in you." And he explained to Julian that in his previous embodiment he had accepted the rite, and therefore that he might receive it again. And because of this, it would be possible for him to restore the rite in his own consciousness. If this was not true, he could not. But because he had already received the mysteries, then for that reason, for him, learning was a remembering of that which was already known. And Maximus further explained to Julian something that the boy himself knew, and which was, of course, perhaps the deciding factor, namely that from his own infancy, Julian had had this great pressing desire within himself to know. He was born, as he tells us himself, seeking truth. Therefore, he could well believe, perhaps, that the soul in him, whether it was the soul of Alexander or some other spirit in space, that the soul in him had already known the road and was longing to find it again. That this, then, by initiation, was the reviving or restoring of that knowledge which the soul already possessed, but which had been obscured to it by its embodiment as a newborn babe. And because Maximus the Neoplatonist recognized in Julian the signs of one who had taken the oath, he was accepted and initiated. And from what transpired then and afterwards, it seems that Maximus very probably was right. Because certainly Julian, considering his age and his circumstances, almost immediately revealed a wisdom far beyond his years, or far out of harmony with the generation and the condition of the world in which he lived. Because Julian definitely belonged to the golden age of Greece. He belonged to centuries that had preceded him. He was a great geographical misfit, coming too late and dying too soon. So in this case, there was this peculiar circumstance involved in his acceptance into the rite. And he and other Neoplatonists reminded their students that where this gift, this power, this strange and inevitable destiny to press on to truth is strong and clear and bright within the human soul, that soul is telling us that it has at some previous time passed through the gates of the house of the mother, that it has received in the past its sacred name, its ordination, and is now only seeking to remember that it may go on to learn more of the mystery. Now we know even in this time, and certainly in the many years of public work that I've gone through, I know that the world is divided into two very general groups of people. Those in whom there is this tremendous urge to know, this urge to release a spiritual destiny locked within themselves, an urge which in its proper and natural form is not an urge to achieve fame or greatness or wealth or authority, nor is it an urge to escape burdens or to shift responsibility or to advance one's own spiritual destiny. It is the simple urge to learn in order that we may give. And wherever this urge is tremendously strong, we cannot but wonder, as Julian wondered, whether it isn't the dim remembrance of the soul of a destiny to which it has already been called by the sacred rites, when it was dedicated to the service of the Great Mother, who is the servant of all. And then there are other souls in whom this hunger does not seem to be, who are happy and content to live their normal lives, who find no call, no pressure, no sublimity to disturb their mortal inclinations. These souls have not been moved. They have not been to the house. They have not tread upon the threshold of the goddess. They have not seen the great gods standing in the light before them. Julian felt this, believed it completely. And there is something about our own daily living, after all this time, that seems to intimate that perhaps he was right. At least we have probably no better explanation. We see the same phenomenon within the structure of modern religion, where we find some who are by such nature devout, that they are completely led by a goodness in themselves, so that it would make no difference to what sect they belonged, they would still be good. And there are others that no matter to what sect they give allegiance, are still not good. This difference seems to be something within the psyche. And to the Greeks it meant that in the psyche of the individual who had passed through the mysteries at some previous time was a record waiting to be awakened. That it could be awakened very quickly and very easily under the proper circumstances and pressures. So Julian was accepted, and apparently he received the full benefit of this strange rite and ritual. For he tells us much of his own longings and his dreamings and his hopings as he tries to unfold without unveiling the mysteries of the Great Mother. Also in this story, or in the orations of Julian, he divides the universe into two essential parts. He describes to us the rituals and mysteries of the Sovereign Sun. And the Sovereign Sun, of course, to him, was this visible symbol of the invisible power of eternal life. To him, the Sun was the father of all living, and the Earth, the mysteries, was the mother of all living. And the union of the Sun and Moon and the mysterious alchemical experimentation produced the psychic homunculus, the mysterious creature of crystal, in whom the two great sets of energies converged, mingled, and produced from themselves the magnificent structure of the living soul. The Neoplatonists taught, for example, that there was spirit and body. And between these two, as a spider spinning its web, the mysterious interchange of energies and forces brought into creation a middle distance, which was the psychic nature. For the soul was the result of life moving upon matter, and matter rising gradually, impregnated with life and releasing life from itself. So the earth also was the womb of the mysteries, the Great Mother. And her temples were mostly beneath the earth, as symbolic of their proper place and residence. And the mother was impregnated with the power of the light, or the father spirit. And between this heaven and earth, dominion wielding, was fashioned the subtle fabric of the soul. Now Pythagoras and the others declare that a soul is properly called a form. Form and matter are not the same thing. All bodies are forms. All bodies are composed of matter. But there are forms of matter which are without bodies. And there are forms which are without spirits. These mysterious things are described in the mysteries of Iamblichus on the Chaldeans and the Egyptians. But what we are told in substance is that when matter is impregnated with life, when substance receives into itself the archetypal pattern of universal law, matter suddenly is brought into magnificent geometric arrangements. Matter is itself a form but formless. Life is unformed, but potential of form within itself. And just as matter and energy unite in the production of the snowflake, so the snowflake becomes a form, because a form is a compound of life and substance, of mind and matter, of consciousness and the elements. And the form, therefore, is body that has been fashioned from matter and designed by consciousness. And the two, matter and consciousness, through their integration, produce the radiant specter of the human soul. So form and the soul are the same things. For all souls are formal structures, and a form is an aggregation of substances around a pattern, a design, or a purpose. So the most minute creatures that we see, a little crustacea and foraminifera and things of that nature are forms like little snowflakes. Wherever life takes abode in matter, it begins to mold matter into form. and form is a symbolic description or exhibition of life's process. And the human soul is therefore the symbolic representation of the state of man's growth in relation to his spiritual cause and his material body. This in turn means that the soul, or the psychic part, is responding more subtly and more immediately to consciousness than body does, is therefore more easily affected and more quickly inspired and more subtly influenced than body. And the purpose of the mysteries is to recognize that these institutions themselves were the physical symbols of the world soul. And because they were physical symbols, they were built in certain ways. And we can begin to understand why in the Dionysiac rites of Greece the orders of architecture were brought in, the five great orders and the polyglot orders that follow them. For these orders of architecture were required in the building of temples, because the temples were dedicated to various deities, that is, to various psychic complexes or patterns. And each temple had to be the complete and perfect representation in stone of the psychic archetype which belonged to that god or deity. Pythagoras, visiting in Egypt, said that he found in the temples there strange images of the gods, because all of the divine beings of the Egyptian hierarchy were represented by symmetrical geometric solids of various shapes and arrangements. In other words, that all the gods were reduced to geometric formulas. The geometric formula, in its turn, is amplified or expanded into the temple, which must have its pillars either Doric or Ionian or Corinthian, according to the deity who dwelt there. The structures of the temples themselves were based upon basic star patterns, as we learn from the Cicerano edition of Vitruvius. We know that every one of these tasks was appointed with the same care, assuming that man himself builds his outer body from the very texture and structure of his own psychic life, so building the temples of the gods. It was necessary that each temple should in every part and detail be true to the god which it represented, because it was his house. And unless, as we are learning from the Bible, unless we build a temple according to the law, that is the law of order and proportion, the living God will not dwell therein. For the God, the power, the dynamic, the psychic reality of the archetype can only be captured when the structure which is to house it is identical with it. In the same way, man is only able to capture the archetype of the great mystery drama if his own psychic organism is identical with it. This strange rapport was of two directions or two kinds. Man could not be sure and could not know that his own psychic nature was identical with that of the gods. But through the oracles and the sacred and ancient institutions, the initiated priests were convinced that they, in the production of their rites and their temples, in the ordination and arrangement of all parts of their sacred orders and priesthoods, that they were fulfilling and dramatizing, revealing, expressing, symbolically setting forth the great primary psychic archetype, and therefore that the mysteries were a geometrical equivalent of the soul. And that just as surely as the mysteries themselves were the shadowed and formment of the soul of God, so they beckoned, called, or opened to the further shadowed extension of this principle, the soul of man. So we understand the meaning of the term that the neophyte or the initiate entering the sacred house is described as going home. He is going back to the similitude of himself. He is going back to his own birth. He is going back to the place where he came from. He is going back to the state or condition which was eternally his, the condition of the great archetype of psyche in space. Thus he returns to the ancient house, He comes back again to the womb. He has returned to his own childhood. He has truly returned to his own infancy. He must come forth again by a new birth. A new birth in conformity with the archetype and with complete receptivity to the impression of the signatura rerum, the great seal or imprint of the archetypal purpose. The initiate, therefore, is supposed to and believed to carry within himself from the time of the mysteries the living archetype of the connection between his own psychic life and the psychic life of the universe. There was no longer any arrangement or disarrangement between these two. They had come together. And because his soul was like the world's soul, it could never be separated from it, because things which are alike can never be separate in time and space. The gradual education or edification of the initiate through the continuation of his studies then became of one purpose only, namely that he would increase in skill and power and means for the expression of that which was his own internal. From that time on, he was instinctively and inevitably master of arts and sciences, because all these things are merely specializations of his own psyche. And as surely as art and music and literature and the dance and poetry and sculpturing and painting and all these things manifest man's instinct to express beauty, so when the psyche is itself ordered in all matters, this beauty is immediately and eternally available, and it only remains for the initiate to experience and discover the ways in which it can be revealed. This is, in substance, the experience of the blessed theurgy described by Plotinus. It is this experience of the one returning to the one, the alone journeying to the alone. That which is like finding likeness, and the soul imprisoned in man, freed and restored to the soul of the world, of which it is a proper fragment and an inevitable part. Thus the soul of the world, the mysteries, and the soul of man meet in the strange rites and rituals of the mother of the gods. And the soul in man finds its kinship, discovers its identity, realizes that it has long been in exile, and that it has found its way to reality. Then, from there on, and for all eternity, according to the rites, this ritual can be revived, and the child coming into the world is born with the subjective realization of its own destiny, and somehow, strangely, gently, tenderly, wonderfully bound to the soul of the world. And from these who are thus bound and thus ordered and thus ordained come the teachers and leaders of the race. Now this is in substance the Julian position, and we can add to it in certain methods and ways. But it not only tells us to a large measure the story of Julian, but it perhaps helps us to summarize the entire concept of Neoplatonism. For this is a discipline by which the individual causes that which is the same to return to that with which it is the same. And that all of these disciplines, like those of the Indian schools, are disciplines of union. Union through the experience of similitude and then the experience of identity. When man's own inner soul is identical in quality and substance with the world soul, they meet, flow together, and become one, and can never again be separated. Part of this mystery is explained in the initiation rite. For in this ritual, the initiate has, at least temporarily, this terrific experience. Later, perhaps it fades somewhat from his mind, because his compound nature is not capable of preserving continuously so exalted a state of spiritual intensity. But even though the experience may not then be forever available or immediately accessible to him, still the memory of the experience then becomes the most blessed of all memories. And it also becomes the memory of truth, or the memory of wisdom, the memory of health, the great good that cannot be forgotten, and which, therefore, is greater than the small evils and the uncertainties which can be forgotten. But nothing in the world, nothing that can happen to man, good or bad, can have the tremendous impact upon his spiritual life that the motion of the soul to the recognition of its union with the great archetype can have. Therefore, in the presence of this, all doubts, all fears, all negations have no opportunity of presenting and maintaining themselves. Thus, the initiate can never completely relapse. He can never forget. He can never fail to experience. He has known something. He has beheld the universe open around him and within him. He has come to know as realities things that other men can only believe or hope or wonder about. And having passed through the experience, he receives a strange and wonderful catharsis. And this experience of passing through, of actually participating in the rite, is the sacrament by which the benediction of the Spirit is bestowed. And in the presence of this benediction and under its tremendous influence, something happens in the psychic chemistry of the individual, and the soul can never be as sick again as it was before. It can never forget. It can never stagger away and die again in matter, because it has received the greatest impulse, the greatest transference of energy from the world soul that it is possible for it to have. It therefore blazes within the being and causes the being more and more to become its servant, until finally the initiate bows before this victorious and triumphant soul within himself and acknowledges himself to be its servant. And so Julian closes his thought or his wonderful dream pictures with his prayer of thankfulness to the Great Mother, to the world soul, which has made it possible for him to come to her as a child to its parent and find in this security of the great psychic mystery of initiation that strange and wonderful security that comes to the small child who returns to its parent's love and understanding. And Julian, as a small child, goes home to the mother, and in going home finds peace and security and serenity. Thus he completes or concludes his dream of this great drama. And I think we have considerable reason to believe from his thought and from the works of his contemporaries that Julian indeed had had this experience, that it sustained him magnificently through the trials of a short and tragic life. And we will hope with Julian that it will cause him to return again in due time with the memory of the greatness of this soul and the message and journey of the soul deep within himself, so that perhaps again in his day he can become enlightened, can revive the mystery, and continue his dedication to the service of the Mother of the Gods. Well, I think that is...